This is the Sunday Catholic Word, a production of Catholic Answers, the only podcast to look at the Sunday Mass readings from an apologetics perspective.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Sunday Catholic Word, a podcast where we reflect on the upcoming Sunday Mass readings and pick out the details that are relevant for explaining and defending our Catholic faith. I'm Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers, and the host for this podcast. In this episode, we're going to focus on several details found in the Gospel and Second Reading for the fifth Sunday of Lent, Year A. The Gospel reading is the story of the raising of Lazarus in John chapter 11, verses 1 through 45. Most of our time in this episode will be spent with this Gospel passage. However, there's one detail in the second reading from Romans 8, 8 through 11 that's relevant for doing apologetics and thus worthy of highlight for this podcast. Let's begin with the Gospel and the raising of Lazarus. I'm not going to read the whole narrative. You can do that on your own. So I'll just read the relevant verses as they pertain to the particular apologetical theme. The first detail that I'd like to focus on is Jesus' consolation of the sisters Mary and Martha. There in verse 4, we read this: "This illness is not to end in death, but is for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it." This connects to last week's gospel reading, where Jesus explicitly taught that the blind man's blindness was permitted so that God's glory would be manifest through the healing. Remember that? Similarly, here, Jesus explicitly reveals that Lazarus' illness and his subsequent death is permitted for the sake of ordering it to the glorification of the Son of God. Jesus even intentionally waits there in verse 6, 2 days longer, where he was to ensure that Lazarus was truly dead. Raising someone from the dead will generate more faith than raising someone to health from sickness. So Jesus is intentional about this, waiting for Lazarus to die in order to raise him to give glorification to the Son of God. So yet again, Jesus gives us his answer to the problem of evil. God permits it only to order it to the greater good of the manifestation of God's glory. For us, seeing the manifestation of divine glory may not come until later in our lives or even until the afterlife, as I mentioned in last week's episode. But in this case, the manifestation was immediate. What the bottom line is that whether it's immediate or later in this life or in the afterlife, there is and will be a manifestation of God's glory in virtue of the permitted evil. And that's something we can take to the bank. Now, an interesting point to note is that in last week's gospel, the focus was on the permission of evil for the sake of manifesting the Father's glory. In this gospel reading, the focus is on the permission of evil to manifest the Son's glory. Perhaps a subtle hint to the equality of the Son and the Father? Perhaps, maybe, something to chew on. Now, the second detail is Jesus' exchange with his disciples about whether Lazarus has simply, quote-unquote, fallen asleep or died. In verse 11, Jesus tells his disciples, "Our friend Lazarus is asleep, but I'm going to awaken him." John tells us that the disciples took Jesus literally here, thinking that Lazarus was only sleeping. But Jesus clarifies their misunderstanding, saying in verse 14, "Guys, Lazarus has died." And John emphasizes here that Jesus spoke to them, quote unquote, clearly there in verse 14. Now, there are three ways in which this exchange is useful for doing apologetics. First, it's helpful for when we're talking to folks about the fruit of the vine objection that's posed to our interpretation of Jesus' words of institution at the Last Supper. I deal with this objection in my book, Meeting the Protestant Response, How to Answer Common Comebacks to Catholic Arguments, so I'll just summarize it here. Some Protestants appeal to Jesus after the words of consecration, calling the contents of the consecrated chalice at the Last Supper the, quote-unquote, fruit of the vine. Check out Matthew 26:69 and Mark 14:25. The argument is that if the contents of the chalice were really Jesus' blood, Jesus wouldn't have called it the fruit of the vine. He would have called it his blood. Since he does call it the fruit of the vine, the stuff in the chalice is not Jesus' blood. Now, there are a few ways in which we could respond to this objection. Again, see my book for further details, but there's one response for which Jesus' statement about Lazarus sleeping can be used here. Jesus uses, big word forecast here, right? Phenomenological language. Now, you might be thinking, huh? What in the world is that? Well, phenomenological language is language that's used to describe things according to their appearance, according to the phenomenon. We use it even today. For example, the weatherman says that the sun will rise at 6 a.m. and set at 7 p.m. Should we conclude that the weatherman is an advocate of geocentrism, who believes that the sun moves up and down over the earth? Of course not. He's simply describing something according to the way we see it, according to the phenomenon. In the Bible, angels and even God were described according to how they are revealed to the senses. The book of Genesis describes the Lord and his angels as men, since that's the form they took when they conversed with Abraham, there in Genesis chapter 18, verse 2. And you can cross-reference chapter 18, verse 10, and chapter 19, verse 1. Tobit does the same thing with reference to an angel in Tobit chapter 5, verses 2 through 4. These authors were not trying to say God and angels are actually men. They simply describe phenomena in a common way as they were observed according to the senses. Similarly, the Bible often refers to death as sleep, as evidenced by Jesus' exchange with his disciples here in John chapter 11, verse 11. So a small little detail, but yet can be used in a powerful way in another context when we're talking about the Eucharist and what Jesus meant at the Last Supper. The second way in which this exchange is useful for doing apologetics is that it's helpful when we're arguing for a realistic interpretation of Jesus' command to eat his flesh and drink his blood in the Bread of Life discourse recorded in John 6. One Catholic argument starts from the fact that Jesus' audience, both the Jews and his disciples, interpreted Jesus' statement about eating his flesh and drinking his blood literally. The argument is that if his audience were misunderstanding him, in which case Jesus would have been speaking metaphorically, then Jesus would have clarified their misunderstanding. And since he doesn't do this, we conclude that he wasn't speaking metaphorically. Now, one of the reasons why we argue that Jesus would have clarified their misunderstanding is that it was common practice for Jesus. So, for example, in John 4, Jesus clarifies his disciples' misunderstanding that the food he was talking about was real food when it was to do the will of his Father. In Matthew 16, his disciples thought that Jesus' statement about the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees referred to their bread, when it really referred to their doctrine. And then this Sunday's gospel is one more example in the lineup. Jesus' disciples think he's saying Lazarus is literally sleeping, but that's not what Jesus meant. So he clarifies it. He was just using phenomenological language. So yet again, we see how this exchange that Jesus has with his disciples can be used in apologetical conversations. The third way it can be used is that it's helpful for when we're talking to folks who believe in what is commonly known as soul sleep. Some Christians and quasi-Christian sects claim that we're not conscious between the time of our death and our resurrection, but that our souls, quote-unquote, sleep. They often cite verses in the Bible where it speaks of death as sleep, like Jesus does here in John 11. But here, Jesus explicitly uses the sleep language as a metaphor to refer to death. Again, this is phenomenological language, the language of appearances, the language according to the phenomenon. This passage, therefore, gives us evidence that when the Bible speaks of death as sleep, it's simply referring to death and is not making a claim about whether the souls in the afterlife are conscious or not. The third detail that's relevant for apologetical discussions in the gospel passage is the hint that is the hint at the Jewish belief in the bodily resurrection. Jesus tells Martha there in verse 23, "Your brother will rise." And Martha immediately responds, "I know he'll rise in the resurrection on the last day," there in verse 24. The church emphasizes this Jewish belief in the bodily resurrection by giving us Ezekiel 37, 12 through 14 for the first reading. There, God promises to raise the Jews from their graves and bring them back to the land of Israel. But how is this relevant for doing apologetics? Well, it provides an opportunity to reflect on the Christian mutations or changes within Second Temple Jewish belief about resurrection. The Anglican New Testament scholar N.T. Wright, in his books, The Resurrection of the Son of God and Jesus the Final Days, has done a great deal of work on these kinds of mutations or changes and appeals to them as evidence for the early Christian belief in Jesus' resurrection. The argument is basically this: why would these early Christians, many of whom were formerly practitioners of Judaism, suddenly begin believing and preaching things about the doctrine of resurrection that were not part of their former Jewish theological belief system? Why the change? Well, Wright argues that Christ's bodily and glorious resurrection best explains these kinds of mutations or changes. Martha's statement about Lazarus rising on the last day highlights one of these mutations. As Wright points out, in Second Temple Judaism, the Judaism of Jesus' day, no one was expected to rise from the dead before Yahweh's initiation of the final age of the new heavens and new earth. Martha's statement supports this. And moreover, it was an event that would happen to everyone at the same time. In the words of Wright, it was an all-people event, as he states in his book, Jesus, the Final Days. But yet Christians claim that the resurrection had already begun with one particular person, Jesus Christ. And with his resurrection, the new creation was inaugurated. For Wright, and pretty persuasive in my opinion, the reality of Christ's resurrection is the most plausible explanation as to why these Jews suddenly changed their beliefs about the resurrection and the timing of the new creation. So, yet again, another detail that's relevant for our apologetical discussions. There's a fourth detail here in the gospel passage that's related to this topic of the resurrection, and it's Jesus' statement in verse 25, "I am the resurrection." Notice Jesus doesn't just say, "I will rise." Here, Jesus identifies himself with resurrection itself. Now, think about this, my friends. What is a resurrection? It's victory of life over death. For Jesus to say that he is the resurrection is to say that he possesses absolute sovereignty over life and death. But according to 1 Samuel 2:6 and Wisdom 16:13, the absolute sovereignty over life and death, that belongs to Yahweh, Almighty God. Therefore, by identifying himself with resurrection itself, Jesus is claiming to be God here. Now, there's one last thing to note about this gospel and its relevance for doing apologetics. The cluster of details that support the story's historicity. Notice the detail about Bethany. We read, "Now a man was ill, Lazarus, from Bethany." Bethany here has no relevance to the end game of persuading others to believe in Jesus. It's non-apologetical or non-catechetical. There's no reason to include it except that it's true. For historians, non-apologetical or catechetical details like this is a good indication of the story's historicity. It's one piece of the puzzle, right, that adds to the puzzle, this being one piece with others that would increase the high probability and likelihood of its historicity. Also relevant are the details about the relationship between Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. along with their place of residence. First, these details make John's claim subject to historical verification. If he were making this stuff up, he wouldn't choose a real place and drop names of people who were relatives. That's stuff that could be checked out by the readers of his day. They could inquire whether there was a family in Bethany with members by these names. So if he's making this stuff up, he ain't going to take this route. Second, these details, again, are non-apologetical or catechetical. What relevance do the names of these people and where they live have regarding the goal of persuading readers about who Jesus is and the power that he has? If John were making it up, he could have just told this random story of Jesus healing this guy who had a couple of sisters without even dropping the names or the place of their residence. But you don't have that, right? John does drop the names in the place of residence, but they have no relevance to the end game of persuading the readers about Jesus. So why would he include it? Well, the only plausible explanation is because it's true. That's the fact of the matter. And finally, third, notice that there's no description about Lazarus's experience of being dead and the afterlife. This kind of restriction, this is a noticeable restriction, right? This kind of restriction in details and embellishment indicates the strong probability of historicity. Why? Well, because when people make things up, they tend to embellish things quite a bit. But this kind of restriction, that indicates they're not making it up because it's a historical fact and they're just going about articulating it because their readers know that it happened. They're part of the Christian community. So we have good reason to think that this story of the raising of Lazarus is historical. Yet another apologetical dimension. Alrighty, now we come to the detail in the second reading. So we're done with the gospel. Let's move to the second reading, which again is taken from Romans 8:8-11. And here's what Paul writes. And those who are in the flesh cannot please God. But you are not in the flesh. On the contrary, you are in the Spirit, if only the Spirit of God dwells in you. Whoever does not have the Spirit of God does not belong to him. But Christ is in you. Although the body is dead because of sin, the Spirit is alive because of righteousness. If the Spirit of the one who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, the one who raised Christ from the dead will give life to your mortal bodies also through his Spirit that dwells in you. The key detail here is the phrase, the flesh. What does Paul mean by it? First, as St. Thomas Aquinas comments in his commentary on Romans, he can't be referring to the nature of the flesh, that's to say, the body. The reason is that he says to the Roman believers, but you are not in the flesh. Well, clearly, Roman believers were mortal men with bodies, right? What Paul means by the flesh is having a this world viewpoint or perspective of reality. Consider that in verse 7, Paul speaks of the concern of the flesh. The Greek word for concern there is phronema, which means mindset or a way of thinking. So what Paul has in mind here within the context is a way of thinking that's focused solely on the flesh. That's to say, it's restricted to thinking about the things of this world, as opposed to, in the words of St. Paul, the things of the Spirit, there in verse 5. This idiom of the flesh, as connoting a this world perspective, is confirmed by John 8:15, where Jesus tells the Pharisees, "You judge according to the flesh." What Jesus means here is that they're making judgments about him solely from an earthly perspective, a this world perspective. The bottom line is that to perceive the things of God, we have to judge according to the mind of God. To perceive spiritual things, we have to judge according to the Spirit, from a heavenly perspective, not according to the flesh, from an earthly perspective. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, well, what in the world does this have to do with apologetics? When discussions about the Eucharist, and in particular Jesus' language of eating his flesh and drinking his blood in John 6, many Protestants appeal to John 6, verse 63, as evidence that Jesus is clarifying the literal thoughts of his disciples concerning his language. There in verse 63, Jesus says this, "It's the Spirit that gives life. The flesh is of no avail. The words that I have spoken to you are spirit and life." The flesh being of no avail is sometimes appealed to as evidence that Jesus couldn't have intended us to take him literally, speaking about his flesh. But this assumes the flesh here in verse 63 is meant to be taken as a reference to Jesus' flesh, which he speaks of in verses 53 through 58. But given what we read in this upcoming Sunday's second reading, this assumption is false. The flesh is a Hebrew idiom that refers to a mindset that is restricted to a this-worldly perspective that's divorced from a mindset that's governed by the Spirit of God. And this interpretation of the flesh fits perfectly within the context of Jesus' teaching in John 6 and provides a better explanation as to why Jesus says the flesh is no avail in response to the difficulty that his disciples were having with his teaching about eating his flesh and drinking his blood. That kind of teaching, friends, cannot be accepted if we have a mindset that's restricted to a this-worldly perspective. The flesh of this world mindset is of no avail when it comes to believing Jesus' teaching about eating his flesh and drinking his blood. We need the Spirit to accept such a teaching. So Paul's teaching about the flesh in this upcoming Sunday second reading relates to conversations about the Eucharist. And so there you have it, my friends. That completes this episode for the Sunday Catholic Word. This Sunday's Mass readings is yet again an apologist treasure chest. It provides details that are helpful for talking about the problem of evil, the soul sleep objections, the Eucharist, Jesus' resurrection, the doctrine of the resurrection in general, the divinity of Jesus, and even the historical reliability of the Bible, at least John's Gospel, right? So that does it, my friends. Thank you so much for subscribing to the podcast. Please be sure to tell your friends about it and invite them to subscribe as well. Also, if you're interested in getting some cool mugs and stickers with my logo, Mr. Sunday Podcast, go to shop.catholic.com. I hope you have a great fifth Sunday of Lent, and God bless you all.
Thank you for listening to the Sunday Catholic Word. Find more great shows by visiting CatholicAnswersPodcasts.com or just search for Catholic Answers wherever you listen to podcasts.